Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
I think we're all searching.
There are some people that think that the media would
bias. They're more biased.
It's Wednesday, November 16th, 2011, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. I'm Mike McKean, director of the Futures Lab at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Here at the Views desk are regular contributors and Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Lee Wilkins and Charles Davis. On the program this week, ABC and NBC duke it out with dueling interviews in primetime, one impromptu and kind of creepy, the other planned and marketed to the hilt to tell a life-affirming story, both deserving our analysis. We didn't get to it last week, so we're taking it up today. A thoughtful but forceful defense of so-called institutional reporting to balance the impact of what one author calls the new gurus of citizen journalism. And we'll consider how conservative commentator George Will and NPR news anchor Michelle Norris have handled disclosures about their politically connected spouses. We actually had enough material for two or three shows this week. It's tough not including these topics, for example, city governments cracking down on the Occupy movement's campsites, new phone hacking hearings in Great Britain, the video of Rick Perry and Herman Cain's brain freezes, Michelle Bachmann using a network news producer's email to claim she's being frozen out by liberal elites, and a CNN reporter suggesting the GOP presidential candidates are, quote, uninformed, out of touch, or irresponsible. Yes, just too much good stuff. But let's start with one of the best breaking news interviews we've seen in recent weeks, Bob Costas's Monday night grilling of former Penn State coach and accused child rapist Jerry Sandusky.
You say you're not a pedophile, but you're a man who, by his own admission, has showered with young boys, highly inappropriate, who has continually put himself in the presence of young boys, volunteer high school coach, volunteer at a small local college, even after you were largely disassociated from Penn State, multiple reports of you getting into bed with young boys who stayed at your house in a room in the basement. How do you account for these things? And if you're not a pedophile, then what are you?
Well, I'm a person that has taken a strong interest. I'm a very passionate person in terms of trying to make a difference in the lives of some young people. I had worked very hard to try to connect with them, to make them feel good about themselves, to be something significant in their lives. Maybe this gets misinterpreted.
Sandusky admitted to Costas, as you heard, that he'd taken showers with young boys. He admitted touching their legs and engaging in what he called, quote, horseplay, but he denied the sexual abuse charges filed against him. He also rather creepily repeated Costas's question, hemming and hawing before answering no to, quote, are you sexually attracted to underage boys? Well, Lee, I'm just wondering, first of all, and let's think about the interview itself and the way that Bob Costas handled himself, given the fact that he only knew he was going to get to interview Sandusky about 15 minutes before he went on the air. What lessons do you draw from that?
Last week, I taught one of my classes interviewing, and one of the things that we spent a long time talking about was how to ask the tough question. I think Costas gave every journalism student and every journalist a clinic in how to do that in a way that put the focus on the subject of the interview, which is, in my view, what is appropriate, and not on the journalist. And that was doubly tough because we had one person on audio only and Costas himself with both audio and visual. So in terms of the journalism that went into doing that interview, I don't think we as citizens could not have asked for much better.
Yeah, Charles, in a one media writer that we mention on our blog, Eric Wemple at the Washington Post, described Costas as, quote, prepared without being formulaic or rigid, polite without being nice, and skeptical without being prosecutorial. Do you think that kind of covers the way he did that interview?
Yes. And it's fascinating to see a guy who is traditionally associated with sports. I mean, lighter fare, talking with people about, you know, how their defensive line is going to shake out on Sunday. He's a master interviewer, and he can turn. I think you just hand the guy a subject and he can do it. How much of that is prep and how much of that is personality? Maybe equal parts. Costas has this remarkably effective way of asking extraordinarily difficult questions in ways that don't sound difficult. They sound conversational, and that's a gift. You can't teach that. He just has a gift for engagement that goes way, way beyond sport. In fact, I'd love to see the guy do a broader interview show like Charlie Rose, where he could sit down and just really talk with policy leaders, because he can do it. He's got the chops.
Yeah, I clearly think he could do it too. But I wonder just a little bit, though, whether or not – and I'm not one of those people who's bashing all of the sports journalists who covered this story. I think there was some good and some not so good. But is this kind of the real sports journalism that we've been looking for in this and some other stories lately?
Maybe. I mean, and Costas usually brings the goods. You know, when things get serious, they bring in Bob because he can talk about serious stuff. I mean, I can remember interviews with Michael Vick, Michael Jordan, right. Other noteworthy sports figures that got into trouble one way or the other who found themselves sitting down with Bob Costas. And I think it's because athletes know that he is a sportsman at heart and that he does love the games that he covers. And so they feel like – even if it's going to be painful, they're going to get a fair shake.
Yeah. Lee, I'm wondering, though, as a media strategy from the other side of the interview, what do you make of Sandusky's attorney putting him in that kind of situation?
I'm entirely perplexed. I don't understand. I mean, I don't know the attorney. I don't know Mr. Sandusky. Having said all of that, I can't imagine a good attorney, and by good I mean professionally capable attorney, allowing that to happen, let alone being there, hearing what was happening, and not deciding to terminate the interview midstream, because it's one of those cases, we don't get them that often in journalism, where practically every question your respondent is just digging themselves in yet a deeper and deeper and deeper hole. And I don't understand why the attorney allowed it to continue.
Yeah, Charles, I mean, maybe he doesn't have a lot to work with there, but it sure was a roll of the dice.
Oh. If he did it. I mean, Sandusky might have done it. The attorney could have been begging him on his knees not to speak. But if Sandusky's that far out there that he thinks it's going to do him good, I mean, that wouldn't be the first time somebody ignored counsel and talked. I've had people do it to me. That having been said, it's another one of these stories where everything spinning off the story gets worse, you know, because then a couple of days later it was revealed that the attorney who's representing Sandusky had himself been involved in a very controversial legal settlement involving an underaged girl and consensual sex, but an underaged girl. The judge who set the bail in the case, it turns out, is a member of the board of Sandusky's charity. It's like, can anyone here do this even remotely correctly?
So let's come back a minute, Lee, to that last piece of information that Charles was talking about. Is it fair for the journalists to focus on the attorney and this legal settlement about, you know, having impregnated an 18-year-old girl if it was consensual? Is that part of the story? Does it deserve to be part of the story?
It's part of the larger story in the sense that I think we've got what one of our colleagues calls nested stories here, okay? We have the story of what Mr. Sandusky did or did not do with underage boys. Then you go out one level, and we have this story about the climate in Penn State and what did or did not happen there. And then you go out another level, and now as journalists we're beginning to talk about how does the criminal justice system handle this. And certainly counsels for both sides, the judge in the case, is part of the criminal justice system. This is what we are here to do, and I think we do far too seldom. It would be really nice if every rape case got this kind of attention. But there are certain crimes that just don't. So in a way, this is the exception, not the rule.
And one nomenclature issue that's driving me insane in all this coverage, can we sort of have a journalistic convention that we're going to call this a child sex case. This is not a child sex case. This is a child rape case. Mm-hmm. And I am maddened by the fact that the Associated Press, the New York Times, and others keep referring to this as a child sex case. That's sickening, frankly, and we need to change that term forever.
And that's all about journalists being a part of the culture, because this is – we call it sex and we think, oh, it's about sex. It's a warm, fuzzy thing. No, this is about power, control, and victimization. There's – sex is just the method.
Right. Well, the other big get on Monday night was 180 degrees in the opposite direction, of course. This was the exclusive interview, or actually it was an entire hour built around an interview between ABC's Diane Sawyer and wounded Arizona Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords. In this excerpt, we can see how far Giffords has come from a bullet to the brain 10 months ago and how much damage is still apparent today.
How do you feel?
Pretty good.
Pretty good.
Pretty good.
I can see that your arm, your right hand, you move a lot more.
Yeah.
Now, is it painful? Is it hard? No,
it's difficult. It's
just difficult.
Difficult.
Yeah.
Difficult. Strong, strong.
Okay. That's the spirit,
isn't it? She's got very good posture.
Yes.
Much better than me.
You do a lot of therapy every day.
Yeah. How many hours?
2 hours of therapy.
Yeah. Here at the house.
Yes.
What do you love in your life right now? We know what's hard. But there's a lot that's hard. But
Africa.
What do you... Africa.
Oh, we're thinking about going on a trip.
Yes.
Yes.
Next summer.
It would be hard for anyone to watch that Gabby Giffords special and not be touched by her resilience or by the incredible work of her therapists and her husband. Lee, how do you take it as an interview for the parts of it that we saw?
For the parts of it that we saw, I think that in a very different way, the interviewer did a good job of sort of pointing things out, like the lack of body movement on one part of her body, which is not something that I think the average viewer is going to sit there and look for in that picture. At the same time, this is one of those times where I think television can be an incredibly unkind medium, but every once in a while, it's good to just let the camera roll. And I think what you see here is her ability to come up with words and her spouse's ability to sort of help fill in around that. And so you see the team effort there, and the journalist doesn't really, Diane Sawyer doesn't really have to ask about it. It's kind of self-evident, I think, in a sort of a nice revelatory way, if you will.
What struck you most about that interview, Charles?
The marital relationship on display. The fact that these are two people who love each other very much and have been through an unbelievably traumatic event and aren't through it by any means. That was the other thing I liked about it. Both – and kudos to the network, but even more kudos to the family for deciding that now was the time, because she's not whole. She may never be whole.
Right.
She's an unfinished product in terms of her rehab, but – she was willing to come and show the American people, like, this is where I am. And I was struck by the fact that it wasn't staged or manufactured. It was – I'm sure there were probably attempts to gauze it up, and those attempts were probably defeated by the interviewer, I hope. And what we got was really real.
You know, what I found interesting beyond just sort of the emotional content of it, we actually learned something, or at least I did something new about the science of language and how music can help us create the sort of these pathways that have been broken in the brain when somebody has damage like that. It was a really interesting science story.
It was a wonderful science story, and it's one of those places where journalistically, sometimes you think you're going out to get a story, okay, in this case about her rehab, and you wind up getting that story, but also this really lovely piece on brain science and the sorts of things that we're beginning to be able to do now. And of course, it's hard not to, for Mike and me and for in different ways, it's hard not to look at that and go, well, for our cognitively compromised elders, you know, and to look at that and to read a lot of things into it, which is, I think, part of the emotional wallop of it, if you will, is you don't just see yourself and Gabby Gifford. You see people that you love who are struggling with many of the same things.
I don't know how you can really compare the two other than that they were on at the same night, the same time. Costas, Charles, had just a few minutes to organize his thoughts. He was on a brand new news magazine program that hasn't done all that well in the ratings the first couple of nights. Diane Sawyer, an established program with 2020. She has lots of time to put it together, lots of time to promote it. And that shows up in the ratings. I mean, maybe it also has something to do with the content of the interviews.
A much happier yeah. subject, which a lot of people were probably fleeing the Sandusky interview as fast as they could. I mean, I watched it because, well, this is what I do, so I've got to watch this stuff. But I got to say, it was nauseating television. So, I mean, I wouldn't blame anybody in America for like going, you know what, I'm out of here and I'm going over here, because the contrast was just startling. And I do think there were stories behind the story. So packaging it as an hour-long package around the interview was really smart.
There was also some, you know, documentation of the fact that people were fleeing from one to the other. Lots of people on Twitter were actually remarking that they'd had enough of the Sandusky interview. They maybe appreciated it, but they wanted to get over to the more life-affirming content.
Well, and it's – we talk a lot about doing good news, which usually for regardless of medium winds up with pictures of cute kids and animals. And I've nothing against pictures of cute kids and animals, but Gabby Giffords really was good news without being saccharine. And we just don't find enough opportunities to do that sort of story. And so, yeah, Charles is right. Kudos on ABC for doing it and promoting it. And I don't blame anybody for the creep out factor in the other one.
I have to say, though, and just to be, the cynic in me requires me to say that the ratings have been in, and of course the Gabrielle Giffords interview did better than the Sandusky interview, but all of the comedy programs over on CBS did even better, double or more the ratings of those news programs. And I don't know what that says, but I don't like what it says. Let's move on to something we promised to talk about last week. We didn't get time to give it the time and attention it was due, so we're going to do it today. And this is around an article by Dean Starkman, who is a longtime crime and justice reporter. He was writing a piece in the current issue of the Columbia Journalism Review. I would encourage you to go to our site and take a look at the piece itself. Read it, because we're not going to be able to cover all of that content in the next several minutes. But there are some points to it that I think were really interesting. And his premise was basically this, that we have a new sort of consensus that's being fomented or led by some folks that he calls gurus of citizen journalism, Jeff Jarvis, Clay Shirky, Jay Rosen. These are folks who are basically, you know, saying how great it is that sort of the institutional journalism that most of us practiced is dying, and maybe that's not such a bad idea to be replaced by, he said, news, quote, assembled, shared, and even gathered by sophisticated readers in a world where the boundaries between storyteller and audience dissolved into a conversation between equals. Okay. His premise, that is the author of this piece, is it that's all fine and good, but Lee, that we need some balance, that institutional journalism, as much as the institution may have been degraded, is really important.
He's right. I think that we are in the process of learning what social media, and I'm going to use that as a big term, is good for and what it's not. So let me say a couple of things. There are beginning to be academic studies of citizen journalists. What are we learning? We're learning that they're kind of one-trick ponies for the most part. They really know a lot about, I'm making this up, your sewers, but they could care less about the Board of Education. And the minute the sewers get off the agenda for one reason or another, they're gone. Institutional journalism, believe it or else, cares as much about the sewers as it does about the Board of Education. And I hope and expect that we will be there for both.
Yeah, and Charles, I certainly don't disagree with the thrust that citizens contribute something to the conversation, that traditional media have not listened to the public enough and incorporated them into the storytelling process. Agree with that. But I also tend to think that there's something there, you know, in Starkman's analysis that, you know, a lot of the sort of cheerleading for amateur journalism comes kind of out of the 60s counterculture civic journalism movement, tried and failed a couple of times to really get the media to be activists in their community. And now that we've got this sort of wired society, that they finally see an opportunity to perhaps finally get their philosophy put into practice.
Yeah, I think Starkman's article, by the way, is seminal. I mean, this is the first piece I've seen at a sort of high intellectual level that takes on the media gurus, Rosen, Shirky, and Jarvis specifically. And we were talking a little bit after last week's show about the fact that, I mean, the title of this thing is Confidence Men. And part of it is, or the confidence game, whatever it's called, some of it is that internet culture. If you go to these conferences around digital media and the future of media, or just digital technology, period, one of the things you will see is that these people are being paid vast sums of money at these very high-tempo rap and rock-infused music pumped into the theaters, and people are paying literally thousands of dollars to be there. And so you've got to be kind of a rock star. And some of these guys have really self-styled themselves, and Jarvis, I think, is the worst among them, as sort of the people who are dancing gleefully on the grave of institutional journalism. And I think Starkman's piece says, whoa, wait a minute. How much of this is about really trying to figure this stuff out, and how much of it is just gleeful dancing on the grave of institutional media? And that was brave, because these people don't broach criticism very well.
And I think that he's right to say that even some of these arguments, which are very valid arguments, are often taken too far by the new gurus. For example, a lot of them talk about how news has basically become a commodity, right? And that's why people don't want to pay for it. That's why citizens want to be more engaged. But the author actually points out that this is not true of local news, or it certainly shouldn't be true. And if we just believe that news is a commodity, Lee, we're never going to try to do anything about traditional journalists reporting on important local stories.
This is going to sound entirely self-serving, but it's one of those places where some of these folks are so ill-acquainted with the research in the field that they propose to be talking about. News has never been able to pay for itself, and according to our best media economist, going back 400 years, there was always somebody else paying for news, whether it was the Crown or a political party or, you know, what have you. So the notion that news is a commodity, I mean, historically, in a lot of ways, it's really quite flawed. And so you go there, and then you just start. Unlike Charles, I live, I guess, in the library stacks in a very sheltered life. but I have to say that one of the things I like, and at the same time fault, about Shirky's book, which I actually have read cover to cover, is that I think one of the things he says about social media is true. It's a great organizing vehicle. Organizing is not building. And that's part of the equation that he literally, I don't think, gets.
Yeah. And I think they really don't look too deeply into what it takes to go up against, as he pointed out in his article, the folks at Goldman Sachs or the White House or the military industrial complex. I mean, journalists have a role that citizens can't easily overcome, I don't think.
Right. Nor do many of them want to.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's where the disconnect in Shirky's thinking. And I like Shirky's, a lot of what Shirky does I really admire, because he at least is self-aware enough to recognize his limitations. And so I admire the fact that he's sort of limited in his thoughts by his own sense of, I don't know, maybe it's humility, God forbid. But there is this ratcheting up in that technosphere, where if you are going to be a guru in technoland, you have to say more and more provocative things. It's not unlike cable television in a way. If you're going to be successful, you have to out balderdash the last piece of balderdash. And these guys are masters. And Starkman just – I don't know. To me, it was one of those – the emperor has no clothes moments.
Well, and as Charles said, I think it is a seminal article about this topic. We'd encourage you to read it. There's a link to it on the blog. But – we need to go to our last topic. We're going to get there this time. Finally, we'd like to discuss a couple of recent case studies in journalism ethics and transparency. Late last week, Politico reported that the wife of political columnist George Will had taken a job advising the campaign of Texas Governor Rick Perry. Subsequent to her hiring, Will did not disclose the relationship while saying all kinds of disparaging things, both in print and on air, about some of Perry's GOP rivals, including Mitt Romney. Well, after the Politico story came out, Will did address the potential conflict of interest while taking part, as he usually does on Sundays, in the roundtable discussion on ABC's This Week.
For more than 30 years, my wife, Mari, has been in the political business. She was a speechwriter for Ronald Reagan's campaign, then his White House. She was his last White House director of communications. As part of her profession, which is to consult with businesses and congenial political candidates, she has been in the political business off and on for 30 years. Last Monday, she became part of the Perry campaign, specializing in messaging and debate preparation.
Isn't she banging her fist against her head then?
No, that's what she's there for, is to fix things. Some of the more excitable and perhaps less mature members of the Romney campaign have tried to make this personal. at the Michigan debate. After the debate, Mari waved to Ann and Mitt Romney. They came over and talked. They'd been guests at our dinner table. And Romney gave her a kiss on the cheek, and they went their separate ways. They're both mature professionals.
You know, an editor at the Washington Post, on the other hand, where Will originates his written commentary, said that the paper would disclose the connection of Will's spouse in future columns. Now, compare what Will decided to do to what NPR's Michelle Norris did last month. She temporarily has given up her afternoon anchor chair because her husband has taken a job advising President Obama on his reelection campaign. Norris also recused herself from political coverage in 2004 when her husband worked for then-presidential candidate John Kerry. She didn't step down last time, though, when her husband was advising Barack Obama. I guess the first thing I'd ask you, Charles, is, I mean, clearly these aren't equivalent situations. One's a political commentator, one's a news anchor. But what do you make of the two different responses to this potential conflict of interest?
Well, I think they're interesting. And for George Will, this actually represents ethics at its highest. I mean, during the Reagan administration, he was advising the Reagan presidential campaign while he was still penning a political column and didn't disclose it until after the fact, when he then came out with another one of those mushy-peed, you know, we're all professional, responsible, mature adults here, which is his way of dismissing the fact that he is conflicted to the core. And he typically is. This isn't new. I'm sure George Will has four different adjectives in his thesaurus somewhere to tell me what they are, because this is another day in the life.
Lee, what's your take on the two different reactions and many other cases of these sort of political conflicts of interest that are out there for journalists?
I was going to say, this has become epidemic. We have a commentator on Fox News who's working on a book with Michelle Bachmann. I mean, it seems like every time you turn around. So a couple of things. First, people who are interested in politics tend to hang together, and it's not real surprising that some of them marry each other. Having said that, So then you have to decide, where does the conflict and the spousal conflict, you know, get into it? I think the only remedy for this, and it's an imperfect remedy, is disclosure. And I agree totally with what Charles said. Maybe we should all disclose. But surely, if you're a political commentator and people look at you for having rational opinions, to say, oh, and by the way, part of the bread that's won at my house comes in a check that's paid for by a political candidate, that might be advisable.
And let me ask you for just a very brief reaction to a piece that we have in Slate magazine that's on our blog. An author saying there are a lot of people think there's sort of a gender bias in the way these cases get handled. Women, when their spouses are connected, have to somehow give up their job because the men can influence them more than the wives can influence the husbands. Do you see anything in that analysis?
Yep.
And maybe you could have 20 more seconds to expand on the yep.
Again, I take some of this back to culture, but I also take some of it back to, I mean, women are and have been, even in journalism, sort of second-class folks for a while. Men are assumed to win most of the bread. Men are assumed to have the dominant income. So it doesn't surprise me in that sense, even though I think it's grossly unfair.
Well, again, the full piece is on our blog, and we'd encourage you to read that. But that's going to have to be a wrap for today's program. You can watch or listen to it again if you'd like by going to the Talk Shows tab on KBIA.org and click on the Views of the News button there. We also have links to extended video clips, as we've been talking about today, and articles related to our topics. You can also add your comments very easily at the bottom. Thanks are due to our technical guru, Director Travis McMillan with RJI, audio engineer Pat Akers with KBIA, and student producer Ryan Williams. And thanks, as always, to Lee Wilkins and Charles Davis. We're taking a break next week for the Thanksgiving holiday, so join us again Wednesday, November 30th, for another edition of KBIA's Views of the News.